You are listening to the Down the Wormhole podcast, exploring the strange and fascinating relationship between science and religion. This week, our hosts are
Kendra Holtmore, and my medieval or maybe early modern intellectual crush is Isaac Newton.
My name is Ian Benz, and my medieval intellectual crush would be Nicholas Copernicus.
My name is Adam Pryor. My medieval intellectual crush, or maybe early modern, is Aisha Albaunia, the Sufi scholar.
Zach Jackson. My medieval intellectual crush is Julian of Norwich.
Rachel Jackson. My intellectual crush is Abraham Ibn Ezra.
The man who started the whole conversation.
He's just the man.
So today we went to I just kicked something on the floor and I feel like that was kind of loud.
I just want to point out that she was the first one to make the loudest noise. Okay, it was not me this time.
Today.
So today we want to address how and why we sometimes tend to talk about religion and science as being in perpetual conflict. So conflicting languages. Religion and science has such a complicated relationship. And so we want to understand, where does this idea come from that there's just like warfare, or that these two things are polar opposites? And I think especially we tend to think of modern science as this value-neutral endeavor. But we want to look at a couple of concrete examples of the perhaps unexpected ways that religion has actually informed scientific inquiry. And not just in like old historical examples, but also now. And so I think what we hope to demonstrate today is that there are a lot of historical and contemporary examples that show us that we can't just reduce this relationship to conflict. And that there has been a lot of conflict, and we're certainly not denying that. And there's a lot that we could say about that, but it's just not the whole picture. So we want to give y'all several stories that will hopefully help you to start thinking about just how interesting and dynamic this relationship is, and how really in each historical moment, humans have always had to negotiate these boundaries in this relationship between religion and science. And so to start out, I just want to give a few examples of the ways that we have talked about this relationship between religion and science. And so you might have heard the language of the warfare thesis, or, you know, just in general, people talk about the warfare between religion and science. It's this like hyper conflict language. If you are a reader of the New Atheist literature, you will definitely see that kind of language in the works of people like Richard Dawkins, for example. And so the warfare thesis became really popular in the 19th century. So the person that's kind of dubbed as being the one to really popularize this phrase is John William Draper. And he was a scientist and a philosopher, lived in the 19th century. And he is the one that really like kind of put this out there, popularized the warfare thesis of religion and science, which basically was to say that Christianity in particular was guilty for impeding the progress of scientific inquiry. And that Christianity, or like the early church fathers especially, they discouraged scientific pursuits for their own sake, because they really wanted people to focus on our need to understand scripture and to like understand the coming kingdom of heaven, but that the focus needed to be on theological agendas, and we shouldn't be like wasting our time, so to speak, doing science for its own sake. And the other part of this warfare thesis is that anything that we acquired through scientific reasoning could not be seen as an independent authority, and that it was always subject to the authority of scripture. So John William Draper was saying, like, this warfare thesis, like, this, it's really like blaming religion, and in particular Christianity, for like taking all of the authority at the time and not allowing science to progress and succeed and be its own thing. So this is something that we see today is, again, really popular in a lot of contemporary literature. But there are other ways to talk about this relationship. And another way that you might have heard the phrasing of this relationship between science and religion is the complexity thesis, or just in more general terms, like there is a dynamic or complex relationship between these two things. And I think that it's probably safe to assume that us like doing this podcast, that's probably generally, I think it's safe for me to assume that that is what we all believe and why we're kind of doing this podcast. And one of the like main figures or proponents of this hypothesis is a historian named John Hedley Brooke, in case you're interested to go look him up. But it's pretty straightforward that there is a dynamic relationship between science and religion and that it's historically contextual. So just to say that it changes over time, and that makes sense, and that in order to understand how science bears on religion or how religion bears on science, you have to look at the historical moment and understand the politics, social factors. It's not something that's abstract and universal and like never changing, but it's very historically contingent. And so we think this is compelling, and I think that the stories that we'll share with you today will hopefully help illustrate that. So I think to start, to just like set a couple of foundational like terms or concepts, we'll just like travel back in time for a minute and look around the time of the medieval period or like the early modern era. We have this thing called natural philosophy. And so the first examples that I want to share with you are examples of how science and religion were really entangled, and that was just more socially acceptable to have these two things as really entangled. And so in the medieval period especially, we have not the endeavor of modern science, which is what we would call it today, but people did natural philosophy. And natural philosophy was trying to understand the natural world around people, but they were doing it in order to understand God's creation. So there is this theological underpinning or foundation, if you will, that supported the observational tasks of trying to understand the natural world. But always underneath those more practical goals was this hope and desire that doing the natural science kind of thing would help people understand the mind of God. And so there was this natural connection between theology and the natural world. And so one example of this is, if you look, a lot of people have probably heard of Johannes Kepler, who is an astronomer and is famous for his laws of planetary motion. But he is a good example of someone around the time of the Scientific Revolution who, like, we would call him a natural philosopher. And he was looking at outer space, trying to actually understand what was happening with planetary bodies and like doing a lot of what we would call science. But undergirding his natural philosophical endeavors were theological desires. And so one of the ways that he thought about outer space was he saw it as a symbolic image of the Holy Trinity. And it's really interesting because he saw that actually the sun-centered cosmos, we have this image of the Holy Trinity where God was represented by the sun. Christ was represented by the fixed stars around the sun, and the Holy Spirit was the space in between it all. So you can see that even though that's not like something that he was literally believing, he had all the symbolism that he was like imposing on his observations of the natural world. And that was very natural and just like made a lot of sense. And a lot of people did that. So Rachel, did you have a question?
I was just going to add that it seems like,
right? If we look at the concept of natural philosophy, it is doing science, not for the sake of science itself, but for the sake of understanding God and yeah. using nature to describe God, just to put a different definition spin on it. And it seems like whether or not it was a literal belief by Kepler that the Holy Spirit is the space between, that was a good analogy that he used based in his science, because science then was the proof of an understanding of a deity.
Yeah,
would you
exactly.
say that?
Yeah, yeah. And even even like other ways of framing natural philosophy, you can find a lot of those even because Kepler, we see that there's this, like you might be doing natural science or like making observations about the natural world and bringing theological symbolism to help understand those things. But there's also the kind of natural philosophy where, for example, St. Augustine, a famous theologian around the time of the 4th century, he uses this metaphor called the handmaiden metaphor. And he says that people, or Christians especially, should only be doing science if it helps to advance theological understanding or understanding of the scriptures. So you should only be looking at the stars and trying to understand what the stars are doing in space if it helps you have a clearer understanding and interpretation of scripture. So that's another way to think about this relationship too. So we can fast forward then, where we've gone from like this medieval example to the beginning of the 19th century. So that's after the scientific revolution, where we start to see, where you can argue that there's a different kind of differentiation, not a total separation, but a differentiation between the goals of what we will come to call modern science and the goals of more theological inquiries. And so one concrete example of that is the rise of professional geology in the beginning of the 19th century. And so I choose this example because what you see is this kind of separation between different organizations or like clubs almost of geologists. You have, on the one hand, geologists who have decided around this time that they really want to separate questions about cosmological meaning from the practical, technical, like problem-solving things that they're doing to understand the history of the Earth and answer questions about Earth. And so they are very intentionally trying to separate those things out. And so this is where we see professional geology taking off and becoming this more specialized discipline. But you still had a group of geologists who would be called mosaic geologists. And they were people who were still holding to biblical literalism and like divine inspiration of biblical text and using that to help them answer questions about the history of the Earth and of humans. And so there, you can look at these two groups and say, like, they're both doing geology, but really the goals and the tools that they're using are different enough that they can't be grouped together as like one group of geologists. You have the more like technical professional geologists that have tried at least to really take out the theology versus the mosaic geologists who are actively trying to use that to help them understand. And so this isn't the only way that this happens, but it's just one example to show that in this, like, as we get further into the modern period, this happens. You have the rise of like specialized disciplines everywhere, but the ones that you were really reliant upon theology are really starting to try to separate that out, and it creates new divisions and new ways of understanding what it actually means to do science.
So it sounds like that what we're looking at there is even if you took two people who are doing the exact same thing, the purpose of why they're doing it, their intention of doing it, and then, so that's the first step, is what is my intention? The second step is the action of, which would look the same. And the third is, and therefore the conclusion is. And so where we diverge is the intention and the conclusion. And I think that's sort of where we're looking at this conflict almost arising, that we might be doing the same thing, but for very different purposes. And I think that for me is the line. That's the difference. It's that you can still take a person who does science, but it's why they're doing it and what conclusion they will then try to achieve when looking at the results of their experimentation.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's also important to note that even people who are trying not to bring the theology to their work, it doesn't mean that they don't have theological beliefs. They might all believe the same things, but there's a suspension of those cosmological, meaning-related, theology-related questions in these endeavors.
Or at least a compartmentalization.
And when that transition started happening, was that because people felt like that theological underpinning was hindering the work, that was slowing them down, because they felt beholden to the church instead of being able to explore freely?
Yeah. I think in a lot of ways, Zach, yes. I think there were a lot of different social factors that were playing into like why people decided to make this separation. And some of them, for some people, did have to do with trying to separate the influence and power and authority of the church from the scientific inquiry that some people felt they needed to separate from the church in order to have the kind of independence to really follow the questions where they would lead and follow the information where it would lead, which would sometimes be places like that information would sometimes lead scientists to places that would conflict with doctrine that the church had set as truth. And so once you develop the tools and are able to have more specific, more detailed answers to scientific questions that we could not have known before we had the right technological advancements, once you have the tools to answer those questions, then you start to come up against the authority of the church, where you're just living in a historical moment where you're able to find things that push against that authority. And so I think, yeah, that a lot of it has to do with technological advancements and a lot of questions about authority that I know I'm trying like not to say too much about authority just because I know that we're like talking about that next week, but
because we will be talking about authority.
Yeah.
Next time on the Down the Wormhole podcast.
I would interject too that from a religious standpoint, so there's one particular personality that I'm thinking of, Baruch Spinoza of the mid to late 17th century, who, this is a somewhat Christian term, but was excommunicated. He was put in lifetime harem from the Jewish people because of that, exactly what you were saying, that when he was looking at what science was telling him, as he further investigated the world, he said, wait a minute, the world revolves around law, not around God and miracles. And that caused a huge schism between his thought and his followers, as well as, and he was rich enough that he was able to actually have non-Jewish followers and survive being put in harem. But his teacher was killed because of these, and his teacher was not Jewish. Because of these ideas, I mean, it was a very powerful, the religious doctrines were super powerful in society. And I think that when we talk about historical context, we have to remember that piece, that freedom of thought, freedom of expression, and freedom of speech were not concepts that were okay from a religious standpoint. And so as these scientific discoveries, right, this was around the same time as the microscope was really being able to discern that which was beyond our eyesight. And that created a major issue. And I think, and that was, you know, almost 400 years ago. I don't think we've left that. I don't think we've left that time. And if I, no, I'll leave it there. Ian, you were going to.
Yeah, so I am. Well, I'm glad you brought Spinoza up. I don't know a whole lot about him, but it made me think about, but I mean, I've heard the name, but it made me think about the little book review that you shared with us, Kendra, on The Territories of Science and Religion by Peter Harrison. And you talked about how it could have been named actually The Territories of Science and Christianity. And so I kind of wanted to talk about that because the way, a lot of times, the way history of science is talked about, especially when you get into the time of scientific revolution later, and when you talk about science and religion, it is more about Christianity and science. And so I have forgotten all about Spinoza, actually, but I was curious, you know, we know about, you know, that, well, at least we, us five, know some about, you know, the Muslim traditions pre-scientific revolution and then during that time frame too. But I just am curious if we could touch on what were the thoughts amongst the other religious communities? Because most of what we've talked about so far is around Christianity. So, you know, Rachel, you may have already answered it, but I mean, what did the other major...
So I think it's hard for us to speak to all the other major religions.
Right.
So I can speak to Judaism a little bit further, given that my intellectual crush, medieval intellectual crush, is Ibn Ezra, who is of the 12th century or so, living in Spain. And during that time, it was both, he was primarily living under Islamic Spain. Right. Okay. Spain was one of those places in the world that shifted hands a lot. We consider this period the golden age of Spain because there were people that were able to, it wasn't the Dark Ages. People were able to have civilization and poetry and writings and philosophy and discourse without discord. And it was a wonderful time. So in as much as any time in the Middle Ages was a wonderful time. So when I look at Ibn Ezra, here's a person who his take is that he wants to understand the world around him. And he uses astrology to do that. Now, when we think about astrology, right, we can say, Zach, what's your sign? Right?
T-Rex. If they're made up anyway, we might as well.
They might as well. Right. Well, I'm a Pisces.
I'm a Scorpio.
So that me.
Gemini rising.
You're Scorpio.
Sagittarius.
Okay.
I'm sorry if I offended you, Kendra.
I'm very offended.
Adam, we're sharing.
Just kidding.
Adam, what's your sign?
So I'm most definitely a Cancer. I'm well aware of this as my daughter got me a series of Cancer pencils for my birthday this year. I feel like I will find them real quick so that I can read some of the slogans on the Cancer pencils to you.
Oh, I'm excited.
While he's finding them, I
am Aries, which, you know, we're known to be stubborn and hard-headed, and I think I fit that mold pretty well.
God okay. of War.
So...
That's okay, right. Here we go. Here we go. I've got Cancers have all the feels. Professional introvert. I'm fine. My personal favorite for meetings, which I'm now sharpening and taking with me to various meetings when I need to go to them. I'm stabbing you in my mind. I'm just going to stay home tonight. And no offense, I just don't like people.
Yeah. It did take you a long time to share your actually, number with us.
It's quite
It's uncanny how every single person born within that month is exactly like you.
All over the world for all
That's
times.
Right.
Exactly.
Anyway.
But I think, right, we're kind of laughing about that. We're kind of going, yes, actually, Adam, you do.
I do stab people in my mind.
Yeah, okay.
I completely
I wasn't
going to
use that one. Oh. I was going to say that you're the professional introvert, but that's fine too. So we laugh at it, but then there's that little nugget in our head that goes, well, maybe. And Ibn Ezra said, not just, well, maybe, yes, absolutely, that God, right, that there's two material realms, that we've got the terrestrial realm, that's kind of where we live, and the celestial realm, which is completely under the sway of the celestial realm, right? So we people here on Earth are like puppets almost of the stars. However, if you want to be optimistic, there's this third secret realm that's above the stars, that if you can have a spiritual stamina to endure whatever misery the stars may dish out, then you will understand the great divine. So for Ibn Ezra, he was combining what we were seeing in the world with a transcendent God, and also merging that with astrology for him, because he's also recognizing that there are things that we cannot explain in this world. We cannot explain why Adam would be stabbing people in his mind. We cannot explain why Ian is stubborn.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, not at all. We can't explain those things, but Ibn Ezra was saying, we can. It's all in nature. Now, we might laugh at that or not laugh at that, but that was his idea. And the whole purpose for him was to really merge everything that he was seeing and say, and oh, yeah, don't forget about God. That can connect to us and be magic and upset whatever misery the stars might dole out.
I try to tell people all the time that just because something is not fact doesn't mean that it's not true. And the difference between fact and truth is an important distinction to make. Like, I don't think that literally the stars above are the reason why we are the way we are. I don't think that there's a solid firmament up there, like some solid candy coating, and on the other side there is the divine that's pulling all the puppet strings. However, I do believe very strongly that there are situations beyond our control, the luck of birth, of genetics, of situations, of accident and happenstance that have in many ways dictated the way that you have developed as a human. And as a parent of two small children, I am well aware of the fact that I am accidentally ruining them every single moment of my life. And there's just nothing I can do about that. That's just the accident of nature. But at the same time, they are not slaves to that. That there is a level above that, right? That is something else, that you can transcend what you've been given, that it can inform who you are, but not dictate who you have to be. That as deterministic as things may be, there is still some sense of independence and free will in determining who you are. So that's, I think that cool story that you shared is not factually accurate, but I think it's true.
I completely agree, and I appreciate the differentiation of those
terms. Just might be trying to play both sides of it because I'm a Gemini.
Yeah.
That classic Gemini
shot of water.
So Adam, I think like one of the, for me at least, the real complexity of these issues, and I really liked Ian's question about like, well, how do other religious traditions do this, right? And like the problem is like, it's a little bit like, I always think of science and religion as like the dating game, right? Or almost like speed dating, right? Like you can put like the various religions on one side of the table and different sort of sciences on the other side. And if they like went past each other, right, you would end up with all these different sorts of conversations. And sometimes there'd be a lot of conflict, and sometimes there'd be like no conflict at all, right? Match made in heaven. Go out and, you know, check each other out at the bar.
Pun intended.
Right. So, but for me, like that resonates with the sort of way that I think Kendra is telling this story about like getting past conflict, right? That we don't really see conflict between science and religion until science is kind of its own thing. If science is natural philosophy, this is no big deal. So it's only when science has got a set of so clear a set of observable facts, right? Observable pieces of data that it can't make fit with the theories it's inheriting, that this really becomes a problem, right? So I think about geology a lot. When you have such good evidence in geology that the Earth is millions and billions of years old, that now this creates a real point of tension with an inherited set of theories that maybe you could have previously used to norm those observations, that the Earth is only 6,000 years old. Now we have a real conflict. I can't hold both those things. And I'm really sympathetic, Zach, to the like fact and truth distinction. But when I get to a concrete case like that, I don't know if I can hold that, right? One of those things has to give.
I think if I can interject there, I think it's that the interpretation of one of them gives.
Right.
It's not necessarily that one of them gives, it's the interpretation of it. So one of the arguments that's made, again, if we're looking at scripture, and I think we can really only comment on the Abrahamic religions, we'd love to look at the other ones, but that's not necessarily in any of our wheelhouses. But if we look at the Genesis story, which is often part of the conflict story with geology, to say that the Earth is 6,000 years old, mm-hmm. and that it was created in 7 days, that the fact that we look at and go, well, if the fact is that we're billions of years old, how can it be in 7 days? And one response is, well, that's God's time. That's not our time. So I can still hold the truth of Genesis and the fact of geology, and they don't conflict. It only comes in conflict if I believe the fact that that a day in Genesis is the day that I observe in 24 hours of a rotation of the Earth around the sun, which if we're looking at science and saying, well, sure, that makes sense. I don't understand.
Yeah. Anyway. So if you treat scripture as a valid source of fact, and not a valid
literal fact.
A verifiable, yeah. testable right. fact, then you're in for a rough ride within the first two chapters.
Or you just have to
right.
bend things.
So if you see it as a source of truth, like no one would ask, you know, is Beethoven's Fifth Symphony fact? That's like asking what's north of the North Pole or what's before the Big Bang. It's a problem of terms. At that point, that the Bible doesn't have facts in the sense that science has facts,
everybody wants to talk. Totally agree, right? I think those are like totally viable ways of doing that, right? But it is a sort of like ship of Theseus problem, mm-hmm. right? So the more that
can
I give away.
That?
Yeah. Okay. So the ship of Theseus is this metaphysics thought experiment, right? So if I slowly have to replace pieces of a ship, right? I have to replace the mast, and then I have to replace the bow. I have to replace all the tenders, and eventually I've replaced all the parts. Is it still the same ship? It's a classic sort of like logical paradox problem, right? So if I slowly give up little pieces of what I assume is the authority of a particular theory, is it still the same theory anymore, right? Or have I shifted it enough, right? I think this is where we see the conflict start to arise, because we have those moments that there's some axiom that I say I've got to hold on to that thing, otherwise I've lost the whole ship. And those are in different places for different people, right? But I think that's the tension that the rise of science really created for various religious traditions, and the place where that sort of like critical pieces is in different spots for different people. And I think that is, to me, the sort of interesting piece, because what I really appreciate about Peter Harrison, right, is that you can tell a coherent story of science and religion without the word conflict, which I think is brilliant. However, depending on which pieces I want to draw forward, that might not always be the best story to tell. I mean, I like it a lot better than many stories that can be told now, But I think that's always sort of important to keep in mind.
I have a thought to that, but Ian, you were...
No, go ahead.
I'm just thinking about like I think what you're saying, Adam, if I understand you correctly, it seems like I want to make sure I say this right. Maybe I'll just forget about what you said. I think about the conflict stories that we can tell as being like nonlinear. Because I think sometimes we can tell the story, like there is a way to tell the story where there's no conflict between religion and science until the modern era. You can tell that story. I think that it's a little bit better though to disrupt that a little bit, because like you do have conflict, like even though we're talking about like natural philosophy rather than like our like modern science, you still have during the period of natural philosophy a lot of conflict when you have like heliocentrism, like in the scientific revolution, of course, is a little bit of a transitional period anyway, but there even like earlier than that, when like the 4th and 5th centuries, where you're looking at a lot of like classical Greek philosophy and natural philosophy, like there's conflict about how to even interpret those things. And so I think of like a family tree, like a genealogy of these like stories where there's conflict here, and sometimes like it manifests in this branch of the story, other times in this branch, or maybe even a better metaphor could be like multiple realities, like the multiverse of the stories. A multiverse theory for the stories we can tell about conflict in the relationship of religion and science. But I just don't think it's...
I like that a lot, by the way.
I just don't think that it's a very linear story, even though I think it's helpful to tell it that way sometimes, because that's like history is always an oversimplification of like what really happened, but that's how we are able to remember things and like write straightforward textbooks.
But and I think the scale at which we tell the story matters too.
Yeah.
Right. So like if we're trying to tell the sort of grand narrative of the multiverse set of stories of conflict in science and religion, which clearly should be an article someone writes. I'm looking at you, Kendra. Right. But I mean, then yes, I totally agree. It's when we zoom into the sort of like deeply personal, right, the almost individual level at which we confront these issues, that it shifts for me a little bit. So I would think about like my own experience of writing a dissertation, which no one should ever read my dissertation. But
me like neither. Don't read mine.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's
link in the show notes.
So. but I think about the ways in which, right, as a Christian systematic theologian, I'm writing about the doctrine of God really fervently. And there are aspects of it that are almost, not even almost, they're immovable for me. If I lose this piece of that, which for me was this idea that God lives, then I kind of give up the whole kit and caboodle. But what that term means, lives, has changed so much in scientific discourse. And I can't easily go back to Augustine or, you know, the early church persons or the medieval figures that I really want to draw on to give that description. And in my description of what that doctrine now means has to start to morph and shift. And I have to negotiate that tension of what will I keep and what will I let go. For me, a big piece of it is that it was really hard for me to hold on to a strong notion of dualism. And that was personally very painful. The idea that it was really tough for me to make sense of something that happens to you after you die. That, to me, that's the level where... And that's kind of what I mean by the Ship of Theseus thing. When I look at those pieces that I have to give up along the way and that change that occurs, that looks really different to me than when I tell the big grand narrative. And I wonder if there are other people who have those sorts of examples of where like that change like occurs in our personal life as we engage this like concept, either a, you know, a religious or scientific concept that sort of like makes us rethink something that we've been holding dear.
I I hope that many of us go through that morphing. I don't want to call it an evolution, because that what is now is not necessarily better than what it was. Just a morphing. And the story that I was actually thinking of, rather than the ship piece, right? Rather than that almost existential concept, right? Like if you break everything down, what's left is actually the story of an overcoat, right? An overcoat being something that's very large. And the overcoat, this person is a tailor. Of course he's a tailor. The overcoat gets frayed and his wife's like, oh, just throw it out, right? We've all been there. We don't need your old stuff from high school. Just throw it out. And he says, no, I need to keep this. And he makes it into a jacket. And then the jacket itself gets frayed. And then he makes it into a scarf. And the scarf gets frayed. And what does he do? He makes it into buttons. Right? And he makes another jacket. And he puts the buttons on the new jacket. But something at every point in his life is still with him. He cannot give up that piece, except that he doesn't hold on to it as just an overcoat that no longer fits and is fully frayed. He morphs it into something that fits what he needs in that moment. And I think that's what we as individuals try to do as we navigate for ourselves. But I also believe that we as a society, when we look at the history of these two fields and say, okay, where are we? Maybe at one point we are this overcoat, the inside lining being different than the outside lining. So I was talking about Ibn Ezra, but I didn't mention that one of the other poets that was around him that he communicated with a lot was Judah Halevi, who wrote the Kuzari, who in the Kuzari kind of didn't make the philosopher. Like, the philosopher was great, but he was not the chosen one in the Kuzari, because that was Halevi's attack at Ibn Ezra to say, okay, we both might be natural philosophers, but you're still not right, even though they were living in the same historical context. So as a society, we then have to say, okay, now let's look at the linings and the threads and figure this out, right? That the coat might show us one thing about a particular period 1,000 years ago, but then we can get a little bit closer and look at the nuances.
Yeah, Thomas Jefferson suggested that the U.S. Constitution should be rewritten every 19 years to give each generation an opportunity to determine how to govern, what worked the last generation, what's not going to work moving forward. Because he said it's absurd to think that I should have authority over the unborn, and that what has worked for us will work for the next generation. Thomas Paine wrote a lot about it too. I think he called it, the tyranny of the dead or something like that.
I gotta admit, right now, if our crew rewrote that thing, I'd freak out.
Like the five of us?
I'm just gonna... No. I'm talking about...
I have some ideas.
Like us? No, I think that the five of us, if we wrote it, it would be the greatest document in history.
It'd be right? Absolutely.
It would be the next podcast, rewriting the Slurpees
exactly.
Every Friday.
I feel like, I'm sorry to get political, but if our current political system was in charge of rewriting that thing with how much they all disagree on everything, I would
Now imagine out. If they were in charge of rewriting it, knowing full well that the changes that they make will be rewritten again in 19 years. That would probably change the way that they govern. If they knew that everything that they did was temporary and then subject to be evaluated and reevaluated by the younger generation after them, don't you think that that would affect the way that they govern today?
Yeah. You know, that sounds a lot like science.
I was thinking the exact same thing.
To bring us back.
Segue.
That's how, no, and I know it sounds silly, but that's
all.
Exactly, science is. And I feel like, through my own spiritual journey these past few years, that's kind of how I wish it could be more accepted within religion.
I think you have understand. To be careful about which religion.
Yes, mm-hmm. I agree. So I'm speaking for myself as a Christian, an Episcopalian, that I think it's important to still, of course, you still recognize the contributions of those before you, which I think in science that's still done. But I think within religion, recognizing the fact that the way that I personally approach reading the Bible is vastly different than someone else, and that I use what others have done before me to inform my understandings of things, but I'm not, you know, you all know, the countless times I've been told that you have to read it a certain way or you don't count as Christian anymore. You can't approach it in the same way that I approach science, of wanting to ask questions, wanting to explore further. So yeah, that's what I was thinking earlier, Rachel. I think it was you who mentioned something about God's time versus our time. Mm-hmm. God's notion of time versus our notion of time. That one of the first things that went through my mind was that wouldn't be enough for me if my religious leader within my church said to me, well, that's just God's time. I'd be like, whoa, hold on. No, I want to dig in a little bit. And it's not to be disrespectful. It's just I want to dig in more. That's just not enough. I don't know what is enough, but I just would like, I feel like that's where I see how some people have gotten irritated with me because of the fact that I want to dig deeper. I want to go further into
the potential. You want to go down the wormhole.
Exactly.
Well, I just was going to say that I feel like we're kind of already answering this question, but I feel like maybe I should ask the question that we're already starting to answer, which is, do you have a personal experience or an experience that you've observed with someone else that helps to illustrate how the people around us or we ourselves perceive the relationship between science and religion? And it might be one of conflict, it might be one of complementarity, but yeah, like, what does that look like for us? And it sounds like we're already there, but just to put the question out there.
One that something that I wrote about recently, and it's a thought that has consistently just popped into my head at random times over the past 20, 30 years was, I remember when I was in middle school, and so I lived with my mom and stepdad, and I was on the phone with my stepmom and dad, and we had just started really learning a lot about evolution in life science that day. And I remember being on the phone with her and just out of the blue asking, hey, so do you believe what evolution tells us about human species and about life, or what God tells us? Just out of the blue, just kind of said it. And I don't remember what we were talking about beforehand, but I just naturally presented it as an either or. And so she said something, I think she said, well, I believe that God made us. And I said, well, I'm really good with the evolution stuff, or something along those lines. And it's not that I do not remember the teacher ever saying this in either or. It's not like I went to church a lot growing up. So I don't understand. I wish I could go back in time and figure out where did that idea come into play in my mind that you had to choose. But somehow I had that impression you did. And I presented it as an either or, almost like a conflict.
Have you reflected on why do you think that you at that time or your parents or whoever thought about it that way? Like, why the distinction?
Well, I think with me, so I think potentially one reason would be is, so during the school year, I was with my mom and stepdad. We didn't go to church. During the summer, when I would be with my dad and stepmom, we went to church all the time, or, you know, weekly. And it was an Episcopal church, and so that's where I got my Episcopal, upbringing. It was every summer. And so somehow, I guess I just naturally thought that one side of my family is more religious than the other, I guess. I don't really know. It's something that when I think about the fact that I even did that, it's so surprising to me, being that I don't ever recall anyone telling me you had to choose at that young of an age.
I'm thinking, Adam, I think you have you have to go soon. Is that right?
Yeah, I do.
Do you want to maybe answer the question next? And
So it's just a really difficult question to answer, but I think for me, one of the formative aspects was that I never saw a conflict because all of the people around me in the communities of faith where I grew up were also scientists. And so there was the prevailing model was that these two things fit together. So that was the operative assumption first. And I think that makes a huge difference. If that's the place where we start viewing how these two sort of sets of, I would say, interrogating creation begin, that they're in cahoots, right? They want to work together, right? It's just difficult sometimes. Then we end up in a very different place. I mean, I think about this term. My dad's a chemical engineer. And I don't think it would be too much to say that for him, that is a vocation. That's a deeply religious way of viewing one's career. That it's imbued with this sense of purpose that's not inherent to the way one pursues being a chemical engineer. For me, that became deeply formative of the way that I look at how these things should go together. And so when I reach those places where it seems like some finding in science is rubbing up against some clear sort of idea that I hold deeply religiously, that's not scary. That's exciting. That's an opportunity to let that conversation unfold and find new ways of holding them together. If that's not the model that people are presented, though, and if that's not the predominating model that people hear in society, then I think it becomes really difficult to think about that as an exciting moment. And I think for me, that's what I see with my students. The prevailing narrative of conflict is so strong that that can't be an exciting opportunity. It becomes
reductive,
a really threatening, reductive structure, right? So, yeah, I mean, I think that's what I would say about that. And then pedagogically, I think it's actually easier to try and do this in lower stakes. I mean, we're doing high stakes stuff because we're awesome and confident, but mostly
this
awesome.
Is true.
And, but I think, you know, like with students, like I'm much more comfortable saying like, well, is a poem true? Let's pick something that's maybe got a lower stakes value for you to affirm that it's true and factual, but not reductive. And if you can start seeing where those pieces are on the sort of, I like chess analogies, right? If you can see where those pieces are on the chessboard, it becomes easier then to let science and religion dialogue. I think, I don't know, probably my students wholly disagree, but you know, I keep arguing that point. Maybe one day, I mean, in a dream scenario, I wouldn't have to start there because that would already be the narrative that we tell. That felt like a good thing for me to stop on because it's going to only go downhill from there.
Yeah, no, I'm about to read a journal entry from when I was 17. So,
oh, yes.
You'll have to listen to it when it's released if I decide to.
I'm going to have to, but that would, and oh man, I'm sad that I'm going to have to leave for that though. All right. See ya.
Bye.
Bye.
So.
So do we want to hear this journal, journal, journal?
So yes, did any of you have a Zanga journal?
I did, but I didn't write in it super frequently.
Or a live journal.
No, I don't know what
or
that
any
is.
Of these, where we thought it was a great idea to make your journal public.
I had a paper journal so that it would definitely never be
Well,
public.
All of these are public.
I didn't
And then I downloaded an archive of it before Zanga went down. So I now have every record of my youth.
Your angst.
Yeah. So I thought that
that's kind of cool,
though.
This
story, I think, illustrates that sort of change in me. And instead of me trying to recount to you what happened and inevitably coloring it with my contemporary interpretation of remembered events, why don't I just read to you the words from 17-year-old Zach?
Please do.
Oh, yes,
please.
Okay. I'm going to try to do this with like the emphasis I imagine I meant it in, but it's going to be real hard because I've changed a lot since then. Okay. So I just got back from 4 days at Princeton University at this political thing. I took two things away from it. I never want to go into politics, and liberals make me mad beyond all reason. Pretty much all we did was sit in the state house from 9 to 4:30, and we listened to politician after politician talk about government stuff. I felt under attack the entire time. There were maybe like three other conservative people there, but every liberal speaker that went up there decided it would be fun if they just bashed everything that I believe. They were all pro-choice, or as I call it, pro-death, pro-gun control, pro-homosexuality, and all about talking about taking God out of every aspect of government. It made me so annoyed. Oh, so much. So the last day, there were these debates planned for us, so we can finally show off some of our political prowess. I wanted to go all out on the conservative pride, so I wore my NRA t-shirt and my revolver belt buckle. So I'm sitting there in the very back, listening to people ramble on about whether or not same-sex marriages should be legalized, when this girl stands up and says that it is wrong, because God made us all in his image and we are all his children, and he didn't make us like that. God doesn't make mistakes. To that comment, the girl doing the discussion said, well, if what you say is true, then that means God must have made a mistake on these people, because research shows that these people were born this way. And if they really are his children, and if they really are his children, that is. And then she started laughing. Seriously, I kid you not. I got all red in the face. I started shaking. I made everyone around me put their hands down so that I could say something back at her. And when she finally called on me, I stood up and literally yelled, I am extremely offended by that remark, that you would have the audacity to say that God made a mistake. My God did no such thing, and that is such a rude and arrogant comment. It is one thing for you to say that you don't believe that he exists, and a completely different thing to openly mock him like that. I was literally shaking at this point, and I must have sounded like I was a crazy man. And she tried to say something back to me, but I really couldn't hear it over the people who started talking and arguing all at the same time. Needless to say, people looked at me a lot differently for the rest of the day. But you know what? I don't even care. I did what I felt like I needed to do, and I have no regrets. But that was pretty much what I had to sit through every single day. God bashing and President Bush bashing. I am so glad that it's over. I just feel so worn down. So that was my Ivy League experience in a nutshell. Add that to the uncomfortable beds, cockroaches, mean people, and people who just go and have sex with people they just met. And that was the 4 days at Princeton. Such a worldly place. You spend your whole life living in this little bubble, and places like this are such big shocks. It's like jumping into ice water after taking a hot shower. But on the bright side, I'm a lot more prepared to deal with these kinds of people now. I'm sure God had a reason for me being there. I'm sure of that much.
Wow.
What an angst-ridden time. 17, yeah. You said?
Yeah, that would have been 17. Yeah, so...
That's a lot.
It's a little hard for me to read those words now.
I'm glad I know bet. That now.
Yeah, well, I lived the conflict model. Everything was a conflict. This is a worldly place with worldly institutions who are... actively trying to tear down my values is what I said. Everything that I hold dear, they are mocking and tearing down and taking every opportunity to do so, even though they weren't. But that's how I perceived it because I was living in the conflict model. And, you know, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? That everything looked like a conflict to me.
I have a lot of strong reactions to that. Thank you, first of all, for being vulnerable and sharing that journal, which you did not have to all these many years later. And I think I'm on the other side of it. I think that where I came from was a place of being that liberal God basher, a place of saying, now I did not have a Zenga journal, so I can't literally read you the words that I was writing in my journal at the time. But they were certainly full of those ideas of how stupid and simple-minded and sheep-like are all of these people who just believe one idea and can't see what's right in front of their faces. And right, and that was coming from a science place, because at that point I was doing things like working in a science lab. I was 13 years old and I was at the university on this summer pro. That was what I did for fun when I was 13. I went to college to be in a lab at UCCS, University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. And I was thinking, how could anybody possibly believe in an imminent and interventionist God? They must be intellectually deficient. And now I'm a rabbi.
Yeah, we met in the middle, it seems.
It seems. I still have, you know, my own theological wrestlings, but my appreciation for diversity and my appreciation for otherness, is in a way that is so much brighter and so much better than I could ever imagine in those teenage angsty years, where if it was something that was offensive to me, it was stupid and wrong. And I feel that the I was also very much in the conflict camp, but on the other side. And now I fully support and love the Venn diagram aspect, where depending on the topic that we're looking at, the two overlap in very strong ways. And there are points where they don't overlap, and that's totally okay with me. So it's I am no longer in any conflict, and that's what I wish for others as well.
Man, now I just wish that I had my diaries with me to read.
I know.
But I think really most of what you would find in my diaries would have just been pictures that I'd cut out of my cat Fiona and taped into my diary and talked about how she was my best friend and how I loved her so much. So
I need you to scan those if you can find them, and we'll put them in the show notes. And if anyone from the Mortified podcast is listening, that was my audition. And if you listen,
I've not heard that podcast.
It is amazing, where people read their old journal entries in front of a live audience, and it's all spectacular.
Yeah, so I'm thinking, like from my experience, I also had a lot of like conflict rhetoric in my education and church experience. I think, as I've mentioned before, for most of my K through 12 education, I attended a creationist private Christian school, and they still taught science, but it was creation science, which, if you don't know what creation science means, it refers to like teaching science, but through the lens of biblical literalism. So like a lot of the things that we've already touched on about geology and talking about like the earth, like determining the age of the earth within the bounds of what scripture dictates. So you like can't understand the history of the earth without understanding that everything in the universe was created in 6 days. And so this was the constraint for learning science. And so, of course, like no evolution and that sort of thing. And so on the one hand, that is conflict. But on the other hand, like part of what's really interesting about like the history and rise of creation science is that it's an attempt to reconcile the two, even though like by the standards of modern science, it would not qualify as such, that it's still an attempt to theologically make meaningful the findings of science. And so I think that it's really interesting because I simultaneously found the conflict model to be true of my upbringing, but at the same time, people are always trying to reconcile those things. And I think it makes me think of Adam raising the question of like, how many pieces of the ship do we replace before it's something different? I think on the one hand, you can see that in the end, you end up with a totally new ship or like a totally new view of science or religion or whatever. But I think where some people might see that as negative, like, oh, you're just replacing everything and you end up with something new. I think there is also a way, and I think Adam also brought this up in the context of his students, where this is an opportunity for creativity and to confront the facts that we are presented with by the findings of science and technological advancements. But humans are creative, and we have, like, even if it's not in the bounds of religion, we are always going to find ways to make life meaningful in some way. And people do that in different ways, and sometimes they do it in more or less harmful ways, but it's just what happens.
This has been episode 4 of the Down the Wormhole podcast. If you like what you hear, tell your friends, leave a review on iTunes or wherever it is that you listen. Check us out at downthewormhole.com for show notes and links to our Facebook and Twitter and email and whatnot. You know, it would be great if you followed us in those places, but even better if you joined us in the dialogue. We'd love to hear from you. And join us next week as we talk about authority and power in science, religion, the Marvel Universe, and chocolate chips. Hey, Adam, you okay?
I'm fine.
Why are you looking at me like that?
I'm stabbing you in my mind.
Oh, jeez, man.
No offense. I just don't like people.
Okay. Till next time.